I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE. Al-Qaeda is back, and this time with the country, aided by NATO airstrikes, CISA sanctions, and a US occupation of vital energy and food regions. Bashar al-Assad fled the ancient city of Damascus for asylum in Moscow. Even NATO-subsidized Zelensky sent soldiers to help Al-Qaeda in Idlib. This week, the Turkish flag has flown over the citadel in Aleppo. Erdogan has invaded in the north, killing CIA-backed Kurds. NATO-armed Israel has carpet-bombed Syria and invaded from the south, destroying supply lines for Palestine via Lebanon. NATO propaganda media, after faked chemical attacks, is anxiously trying to rehabilitate Abu Muhammad al-Jolani, not his real name, as the president of Syria. The terrorist with a Tony Blinken $10 million bounty on his head has already done an interview dressed like Ukraine dictator Zelensky for CNN. An ISIS and Al-Qaeda leader, he was tortured at Abu Ghraib by the US for slaughtering American soldiers in Iraq. As his genocide continues in Palestine, Netanyahu claims Israel secured the black flags of ISIS flying over the Umayyad Mosque in Damascus. In Chicago is Professor John Mersheimer, co-author of The Israel Lobby and US Foreign Policy and How States Think, The Rationality of Foreign Policy. Professor Mersheimer, thanks so much for coming back on Going Underground. I guess first, your reaction, the victory of the United States and Israel in neutralizing Palestine's facilitator, Turkey invading in the north, Israel, as I said, from the south, Russia losing its military bases, presumably, we can talk more about that, China, the end of its Belt and Road as far as its port in the west.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many implications of what's going on as a result of the collapse of Syria that it's hard to know where to start. I mean, it's quite clear that the losers in this conflict were Iran, Russia, and Hezbollah. There's no question that for Iran, this is a big blow in the sense that Syria was an ally, an important ally. And very importantly, Syria was a conduit for Iranian weapons to get to Hezbollah inside of Lebanon. And for the time being, at least, that conduit has been shut down. I think the Russians also lost because they were supporting Syria. And of course, Hezbollah lost for the reasons I just described. And the winners are clearly Israel, the United States, and Turkey. How this all plays out moving forward is almost impossible to say, other than it looks like there will be considerable chaos in Syria for the foreseeable future, because it's hard to see a coherent government forming in Damascus that can control the entire country.
I presume you mean short-term success as regards the United States. I don't know when the Mujahideen had a great deal of success in Afghanistan against the Soviets. They were celebrating in some NATO propaganda newspapers and television, and that arguably would lead to 9/11. Is it a short-term success in terms of the United States, and do you see the hand of a frenetic Blinken State Department here ahead of the inauguration of Trump on the 20th of January?
Well, it is a short-term success. There's no question about that. What happens in the long term is somewhat difficult to say. But it is possible that as a result of what's happened in Syria, that Iran will acquire nuclear weapons. And if Iran acquires nuclear weapons, that would be disastrous for Israel. And it would also be disastrous for the United States. And who's to say whether that will happen or not? It's also just not clear what the implications are for Turkey in all of this. I think the Turks believe that overthrowing Assad would lead to a new Syria that would be friendly with Turkey and allow Turkey to solve a lot of its problems, especially with the Kurds. But I wouldn't bet a lot of money on that. I think there's going to be a great deal of unrest in Syria for the foreseeable future. And this short-term victory for Turkey will not turn out to be a positive development in the long term. So
I want to go to Iran in a second, but on Turkey, as you just said, I mean, how much American weaponry did these Kurdish groups have to attack Turkey asymmetrically? Can we expect bombs in Istanbul and Ankara this Christmas?
Asymmetrically. Very hard to say. I mean, there'll certainly be incentives to do that. But I'm not sure what's going to happen on that front.
And in terms of timing, I mean, if the State Department and the Biden regime is desperate to get things moving and the chaos in place, Iran better make a move on about the nuclear weapon. Of course, Khamenei on record for saying it was un-Islamic. But do they need the nuclear weapon before January? And can they produce a nuclear weapon in that sort of time? They can't, can they, Iran?
They don't need a nuclear weapon before January. I mean, there's every indication that the Biden administration is as hardline on Iran as the Trump administration will be. So I think what happens on January 20th doesn't matter to the Iranians. With regard to developing a bomb, they have not made that decision yet, as best we can tell. But there are all sorts of good reasons to think they will. There's no question that they can produce enough fissile material for a bomb in a couple weeks' time. They're that close. But having the fissile material is not the same as having a bomb. And it would, in my opinion, take them a good year to develop a bomb and the capability to deliver that bomb.
Yeah, on the January 20th deadline, I was actually saying Trump was more on the peaceful side of things, arguably, than the Biden administration. So Iran has to get a move on because Trump would try and seek some sort of peace, unlike the Blinken State Department, is what I was referring to. I mean, is it your understanding that this Biden administration wants to sow as much chaos as possible for Trump?
Well, I think there's not much question about that. I think with regard to both Ukraine and with regard to the Middle East, what the Biden administration would like to do is lock Trump in and give him as little maneuver room as possible. But I don't think they have to worry that much. I don't think that Trump is going to radically alter American foreign policy in the Middle East for one second. The administration is filled with hawks who want to destroy Iran if they can, or at least affect regime change. And Trump himself is a hawk on Iran. I think if Trump is going to have any effect on foreign policy, and in other words, if he's going to change foreign policy in any meaningful way, it will be in Ukraine, not in the Middle East.
I think there was some hopeful people who support Vladimir Putin saying perhaps it was Russia taking Assad out of the situation in Damascus to sow the chaos because he believes it'll blow back somehow. Wishful thinking, arguably, as arguably was the wishful thinking coming out of the Russian foreign ministry that the two bases were safe on the Mediterranean. How important are these bases? And does this mean the end of Russian power in the Middle East? Certainly, in terms of an expression of power, if the bases in Tartus and Latakia are gone?
Well, I think there's no question that that Syria was important for Russia for purposes of having influence in the Middle East. They don't have any bases anyplace else. And if they lose those bases in Syria, it's hard to see where they can go. As you know, it's not clear they're going to lose the bases. And in my
opinion, What do you think?
That I don't know. I mean, it's just impossible to say at this point in time. One sees evidence that the regime is cooperating with the Russians and not interested in throwing the Russians out, the new regime. And one can make an argument that the Russians have an interest in staying. One could also make an argument that the Russians ought to just cut their losses and get out because it just doesn't matter that much. I think what's happened in Syria is a bigger blow to Iran than it is to Russia. From Russia's point of view, this is basically a sideshow. For Russia, what really matters is what's happening in Ukraine. They would have preferred that Assad remain in power in Syria, but it was not altogether that important to them. Because again, throwing their weight around in the Middle East is not of great importance to the Russians at this point in time.
Well, it's connected to BRICS or the Belt and Road Initiative for China. And it is clearly important to have that Mediterranean presence.
I think it's somewhat important for the Russians. I don't deny that. I think all things considered, the Russians would have preferred that Assad stay in power for sure and that they keep the bases. But I think if they lose the bases, it's not that big a deal because wielding influence in the Middle East in the final analysis is not that important to the Russians.
But if they'd preferred it, it was dead cheap to support Syria for Iran and Russia as compared to, I agree, obviously it's more important to Iran. It's existential, arguably, to Iran, and that's how Tehran would see it. Why didn't they pour the money in that was needed to shore up the opposition to ISIS and al-Qaeda in Syria?
I think that they were committed to helping Syria defend itself against HTS and the other groups. There's no question about that. But the problem they faced is that Syria was incapable of defending itself. And there were just limits to what both the Iranians and the Russians could do. There's all sorts of evidence the Russians and the Iranians were talking to Assad about the problems in his military and the need to fix the military and the need to reach some sort of accommodation with Erdogan and Turkey and with the rebels to head off this problem. And it's also quite clear that they were doing what they could to provide assistance once the conflict started. But the fact is that the Syrian military was so hollowed out, it was so weak that it just couldn't stand up to the rebels.
But clearly, they weren't giving as much money as your generous U.S. Public money and the benefactors, your U.S. taxpayers, were giving way more money, so much money that Ukraine was able to send soldiers to Idlib to train the al-Qaeda people, according to the Washington Post.
Money is not the issue here. I mean, just go back to the Vietnam War. We gave huge amounts of money and huge amounts of equipment to the South Vietnamese military, much more so than the Soviets or the Chinese gave to the North Vietnamese. But the fact is, the South Vietnamese military was an incompetent military. And when the North Vietnamese attacked in 1975, the South Vietnamese military quickly collapsed. And this is an analogous situation. The Syrian army was simply incapable of standing up to the rebels. It collapsed almost overnight. The Russians tried to help. There were Wagner forces in there. The Russians were using their air force. But if the Syrians are not going to put up a fight, there's not much the Russians can do or not much the Iranians can do. And you might say, well, why didn't they try to fix this problem beforehand? And my point is there's a lot of evidence that they were trying to fix the problem. They were warning Assad that he had to do something to head this problem off at the pass, but they couldn't make any progress with Assad. He was a remarkably stubborn and foolish man in the end. And as a result, he's now sitting in Moscow and his country is occupied by the rebels.
Professor Mersheimer, I'll stop you there. More from the University of Chicago Scholar after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with Professor of Political Science at the University of Chicago, John Mersheimer. Professor Mersheimer, you were telling me about how stubborn Assad was in Syria, but sanctions on Syria were clearly important, although historically they've never worked, U.S. sanctions. They obviously haven't worked on Russia. They don't work on Cuba, Venezuela, don't work on North Korea. Perhaps then you need a U.S. troop presence, like occupying the energy fields added to the sanctions for it to make an impact. What do you think this means for U.S. sanctions, the fact that they successfully destroyed Syria using sanctions?
Well, it was not just sanctions that destroyed Syria. I mean, there were a number of other key factors at play as well. First of all, there was just a huge amount of corruption by almost all accounts inside of the Syrian military. Furthermore, there were these oil fields out in the eastern part of Syria that before the war produced about $400 billion in revenue. And what happened is that the Americans and the Kurds basically took over those oil fields, and the amount of money that the Syrians are getting from those or were getting from those oil fields had been remarkably reduced. So they didn't have much of an economy at home. The sanctions were on them. There was a great deal of corruption. And as a result, the army was hollowed out. And what we have seen happen in the past few weeks is that army collapsed because it was hollowed out.
So can we expect a Turkey-Qatar gas pipeline to compete with U.S. LNG coming to Europe after the Nord Stream was destroyed? Is this actually not so good for the United States in terms of geopolitical realignment in this region financially?
It's very hard to say. I'm just not sure what's going to happen on that front. There are just so many questions that are open here that are hard to answer, and this is just another one of those.
I mean, why do you think at the State Department they were just blank? I mean, they're always blank faces at those press conferences, but the $10 million bounty is still on the website of the U.S. State Department of Tony Blinken's. So what, I can get $10 million if I tell your government information about how to kill Jalani, whatever his real name is?
You're asking me, am I surprised that that's up there? I am surprised that they haven't taken it down. I mean, it's quite clear that the administration and the mainstream media in the United States is doing everything they can to clean up Al Jalani and portray him as a changed man, to make him look like he's now Thomas Jefferson and no longer an Al-Qaeda operative. So the fact that they've left that up on the website is somewhat surprising.
What do you think goes through the heads of all those journalists on the newsrooms, on the coalface at your broadcasters and your big newspapers, knowing full well the pictures coming through on social media of churches being destroyed, Hafez al-Assad's mausoleum being destroyed, and executions and the ISIS flags all across Syria? What goes through their heads?
I think that most of them are not going to be surprised at all. I mean, it's just not surprising. We basically threw our lot in with a number of Al-Qaeda and ISIS operatives, and they won, and they have scores to settle.
Yeah, but sorry to interrupt, but they keep telling the public in the United States, I know the United States is more interested in UnitedHealthcare CEO, arguably, but certainly in information in Western Europe on news is, no, this guy's good. And look how terrible Assad was and what a torturer he was, as if Guantanamo Bay didn't exist. What goes through the heads of the journalists knowing full well they must know who the ISIS, Al-Qaeda people are? They killed American soldiers.
Yeah, of course. I mean, these journalists understand full well. Most Americans understand full well. There's all sorts of discourse, you know, in the media here on this very issue that the United States is supporting terrorists and that the terrorists or the rebels, call them what you want, have won. But I think when you ask what's going through their head, I mean, it's pretty simple. Everybody knows the basic story here.
You know, a lot of people say that U.S. policy is about creating chaos. Actually, I think I interviewed the president of Eritrea, a country arguably most sanctioned in the world, and he said it was all about chaos. I know you've been predicting the defeat for Zelensky in Ukraine, but you don't think that there are some in the State Department who believe at least create as much chaos as I think it was how many billion? 20 billion from the United States as part of a $50 billion G7 loan paid by interest on frozen Russian people's money to kill Russian soldiers. How well do you think the chaos is going in Georgia, Romania, Moldova, Azerbaijan? I mean, Blinken has got all-seeing eyes here. Isn't it an incredibly competent State Department?
I don't think American policy is to create chaos in places like Ukraine or in places like Syria. I think what we were interested in Syria was regime change. We wanted to get rid of Assad, and we thought that we could put in place a government that would be friendly to the United States and, most importantly, friendly to Israel. I think the United States believes that chaos in Syria would not work to our advantage and it would not work to Israel's advantage. With regard to Ukraine, I think our basic goal there was to deal the Russians a severe blow, to defeat them on the battlefield in Ukraine, weakened Russia to the point where it was knocked out of the ranks of the great powers. I don't believe that we wanted to purposely sow chaos in Ukraine and effectively wreck Ukraine. I don't think that was the goal. One could argue that the end result is that we're wrecking Ukraine. That's been my argument all along. And one could argue that the end result of what we're doing in Syria is to create chaos. But that's not the same thing as saying that that was the intended goal to start with. It's just a way of saying that the United States, because of its boneheaded policies, oftentimes does end up creating chaos, which is at odds with what it wants to do.
So they actually believed that they could defeat Russia?
I think there's no question that they believe they could defeat Russia. I think if you look at how the Ukrainian military performed on the battlefield in 2022, that was when the war started. The war started in February 2022. If you look at how the Ukrainian military performed on the battlefield, and you look at the fact that the Russians in the summer, late summer, early fall, retreated from the western part of Kherson and retreated from Kharkiv. And also, if you look at the fact that the West thought, and the United States especially, thought that sanctions would bring the Russians to their knees, the West concluded, based on those two factors, that it could deal Russia a devastating blow. That seems ridiculous now when you think about what's happened in 2023 and 2024 and where we are at today. But if you go back to late 2022, it looked like we were in excellent shape. It looked like the sanctions might work. And also it looked like the Ukrainians were doing very well on the battlefield. And there was all sorts of talk about how incompetent the Russian army was. So that led us to believe that we could actually defeat the Russians.
You never believed it though, Professor, at any point, all through it.
I did not.
Obviously they weren't clearly not listening to you. But now, of course, infamously, when Putin said that the nuclear doctrine was changing as regards nuclear weapons, I think one of your papers, it could have been Salzberger's New York Times or the Bezos Washington Post, that it was just a yawn in the State Department when these new ideas of use of nuclear weapons were emerging from Moscow. What is Putin going to do as these new longer-range weapons are increasingly being engaged against Russia?
Well, you want to remember that Putin has two goals here. One is to win the war in Ukraine, and number two is to make sure that the conflict doesn't escalate into World War III. Putin has a deep-seated interest in defeating Ukraine, and he also has a deep-seated interest in avoiding nuclear war. So I don't believe that Putin is likely to use nuclear weapons unless he is in a position where it looks like Russia is going to lose the war in Ukraine. But that's not going to happen. So I think that there's little chance at this point in time that Russia will use nuclear weapons. But there's no question that the Russians understand that they're facing an existential threat in Ukraine. And there's no doubt that the Russians understand that the United States has its crosshairs on Russia, and that's not going to change even when Donald Trump comes into power. So as a consequence, the Russians are sending a very clear signal that if the Americans push too far, and they do back Russia into a corner, they should fully understand that Russia has lowered the nuclear threshold, which means that it is likely to use nuclear weapons if it's in that situation.
Except Russia keeps talking about their new hypersonic missile. And are we talking literally about this Christmas, really? Because ahead of Trump's inauguration, Trump, who has said, I mean, as you say, he's appointed all these hawks who support war with Russia, but Trump says he's going to change policy. So it's all about the next 3 weeks. And Russia has to come up with some strategy and some responses and how to reply to increasing provocation ordered by Blinken, Jake Sullivan, and the rest of them, literally in the next 3 weeks. It's all going to happen now.
Yeah, but the problem is that these provocations are not that significant. It's not like These ATACMs that Ukraine is firing at Russia are having a major impact on the course of the war. They're just not. So there's no question that the Russians have to retaliate, and it has to be a forceful retaliation against any use of ATACMs or storm shadows or what have you. But the Russians don't have to do too much. They certainly don't have to use nuclear weapons. And what's going to happen here is that in a few weeks, we're going to have a new government, and we'll see what happens then.
And just finally, how soon can we expect the blowback for these policies of the Biden era of supporting ISIS, Al-Qaeda in Syria? Zelensky is supporting, with American weapons, the ISIS, Al-Qaeda elements in Syria. All these years, 4 years of foreign policy, billions of dollars of your public money, how soon are the blowback going to be felt in the mainland of the United States with asymmetric warfare?
Well, as I said to you before, it's just impossible to say with any certainty when we should expect blowback. First of all, we just don't know exactly how things are going to play out in Syria. But furthermore, we find it very difficult to guess as to when the blowback will take place. I think there's going to be significant blowback. I think there'll be significant blowback for what's happening in Gaza. Many people around the world think that the United States is complicit in the genocide. They think that Germany and West Europe more generally is complicit in the genocide. And one can hypothesize all sorts of plausible scenarios where you get blowback there. So I think the potential for a blowback in the West as a result of what's been happening in the Middle East since October 7th is huge. But predicting exactly when that will happen and what it will look like is, I'm sad to say, impossible.
Professor John Mersheimer, thank you.
You're more than welcome.
That's it for the show. Our continued condolences to those surviving UK-US EU armed genocide here in this region. We'll be back on Monday with the legendary Pink Floyd frontman Roger Waters. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media. If it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV on rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Monday.